KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
We start with our special guest, who is the author of many, many books, and he has a brand new one out. It's called Understanding Trump. And it is the newest book from the former Speaker of the House of Representatives. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, Newt Gingrich. Congressman Gingrich, how are you, sir?
Well, it's great to be with you and have a chance to chat with folks.
Thanks for coming on. The book is in stores, by the way, folks. It's available at Amazon bookstores and, of course, in e-reader form. And obviously, you have had many interactions with President Trump over the years, and you are uniquely positioned to explain to us some of the mysteries of Donald Trump. Well, then we might as well start with the one that everybody's talking about. What motivates Donald Trump to tweet before 6 o'clock in the morning about a show that has an audience of 600,000 people in the entire country of 340 million? Why get into a fight with Joe Scarborough, Mika Brzezinski, when you've got important policy decisions that you want the country to focus on?
Well, let me say, first of all, I think it was a mistake, and I think the tweets themselves aren't defensible. But I think Trump came out of New York and out of that very intense media environment with Page Six and all that. And his whole career, he had fought with these guys, and he actually likes fighting with them. I mean, it's something that's a part of his personality that doesn't fit being president, but it's who he had been really for over 30 years. And he was always, one of the things you can count on with Trump is a counterpuncher. You hit him, he has just this almost automatic instinct to hit you. Which, when you get to be president, is frankly not as helpful as it could be. And I think that there are times when he's having a great day, and then he undermines his own day. So I didn't call my book Predicting Trump because I don't think you can. But I do think you can sort of understand his patterns, but you can't predict exactly which pattern is going to show up which morning.
Is there anybody in his life or in his circle that he listens to? I mean, you know, traditionally, if nobody else, it would be the first lady could say, don't do that. And we know Melania has said in the past, sort of half cryptically, that she wishes his Twitter account would go away. But is there not anybody could say, you've crossed the line here, don't do this. It's destructive.
Look, I think a number of, let me draw a distinction. Lots of people talk to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump listens to lots of people, but he doesn't obey anyone. He is truly his own person. I've told him directly that I think, I said to him, 10% less Trump would be 100% more effective. And he said, are you talking about my tweets? I said, yes. That, I like about 80% of his tweets. I think 80% of his tweets actually are good and he should do them. But the other 20% range from not helping you at all to hurting you badly, and I don't think he's quite gotten that yet. This may be one of those episodes that actually does teach him something about how self-destructive this is, because he had a good week going. There were a lot of positive things happening. They were talking about energy. They were meeting with the president of South Korea. They were lining up a whole number of things that were very positive, and this steps on all of it. It gives the news media something simple and stupid to talk about for 2 days.
Yeah, in fact, yesterday Congress passed Kate's Law and some very, very important legislation on illegal immigration, and it just got buried in the tweet storm. We're talking with a former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, whose new book is called Understanding Trump. It's now available, and you can follow Newt on Twitter at Newt Gingrich. Look, Twitter is a modern way of communicating with the people. The president said that early. He's right about that. Barack Obama and many others have bypassed traditional media sources by going to the pop culture entertainment. We're out here in Los Angeles, Newt. We used to have, motorcades going up to Ellen DeGeneres' show or Jimmy Fallon every 5 minutes. So I don't begrudge him that. It's just whether or not it's productive or not. And does it repel or does it attract? Most presidents want to persuade the persuadable. And bring more people along.
Right, and I think that Trump in that sense is not a strategic guy. Trump is a very immediate, hands-on guy. And I think that the fact is, if you look around, that there is really 80 or 90% of the time, what he's doing is very productive and very effective. And that marginal last 5 or 10% undoes a great deal of the good he's doing. So I'm hoping he will learn that.
Mr. Gingrich, what is Trump's decision-making process? How does he arrive at the policies and the pronouncements that he makes?
Well, look, I think that he listens to an amazingly wide range, and frankly, having become president, he listens to and talks with a lot of foreign leaders. If you look at his daily program, he's meeting with the president of India, talking with the president of Indonesia, meeting with the president of South Korea. So he gathers information very widely. He puts it against his own life experiences and his own biases, and then makes decisions. And I think that he has been very successful. And I think this is one of the key things that, but one of his great strengths and great weaknesses is he has been so successful that when you go in to see him, he knows he beat 16 other Republicans for the nomination. He knows he beat Hillary Clinton in a billion-dollar campaign. He knows he beat the elite media. He knows he's a billionaire. So he looks at you and he goes, okay, tell me again why I'm listening to you. That's a, and yet the presidency is so big and so complicated, you have to listen to a lot of people. And he does. And when he's done with all that, he basically responds to his own gut. That he then does, what he thinks is the right thing to do.
Fake news and the elite media and the sort of feeding frenzy that has hovered around this candidate and this president. Certainly I've been critical of him more than I've been supportive, although I do support him on key issues, including immigration. What should the proper role of media be in the era of Trump, where we have this very unusual president who gets into the gutter? Sort of most campaigns, as you know, end up in the gutter. You could arguably say his started in the gutter by an insult barrage against his Republican competitors, and it's never really changed. So he's an unusual guy to cover. What should the role of media be in the age of Trump?
Well, look, I think actually the same as it should have been under Obama, where the media didn't explore things. I mean, it's a little bit like there's a story running this morning that apparently the New York Times started, which is that when the last administration talked about that there were 17 intelligence agencies that unanimously agreed, there were only four. 13 of them weren't involved at all, and in fact the four weren't unanimous. So I mean, you have to report accurately what's going on. I think that's I have no problem when the president does a tweet that deserves lots of attention that's negative. He's a big boy. He made that decision. I have no problem with the media paying attention. But when that means that they don't cover tax law, they don't cover health care, they don't there's some got to be some kind of balance here. And I'll give you an example. We were in France on the 6th of June. My wife's band, Clista's band, played at Normandy in honor of the liberation of Europe. And we then went to Paris, and five members of the band were actually in Notre Dame when a terrorist with a hammer attacked a French policeman outside, and they had to sit in there for about 2 hours. And one of them had her smartphone with her, and she was switching back and forth between BBC and CNN, and she said it was unbelievable. BBC's covering the attack in Paris. CNN has some panel attacking Trump.
Yeah, we see that and constantly.
She said that the difference in coverage was just unbelievable. And I think that's why you end up with this whole fight over fake media and so forth. I am for a vigorous and aggressive news media. I think that Jefferson was right that a free press is at the heart of our freedoms, and that without a free press we will, we will rapidly lose our freedoms. But the free press ought to be based on facts. Not on making things up.
The book is called Understanding Trump. Newt Gingrich, New York Times bestselling author and former Speaker of the House of Representatives. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Great talking to you.
This weekend in Las Vegas, the legalized pot industry got to roll out for the first time. And let's talk about what that was like with the editor of the Nevada Independent. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show, John Ralston. John, how are you?
Hi there.
Hi is the key word. Welcome aboard. So, you know, we've had it for a while here in California, of course, the Pacific Northwest and Colorado. But if for some reason, Vegas in particular, having legalized pot, really got the nation's attention, because we do look at Las Vegas as the place where we can go to indulge in things that we might not normally indulge in. But this is becoming more and more a normal thing for America.
Yes, this will be the first time that anyone has actually smoked pot in Nevada, of course, as you know.
Exactly.
Listen, we've been seen as a libertarian state for a long time. And the way that this got passed, in case your listeners don't know, is that it was put on the ballot in 2016 and passed by a fairly wide margin, almost 10 points. This is 15, 16 years after medical marijuana was passed here in Nevada. It took them a long time to get the medical marijuana industry going. A variety of legal and political hurdles stopped them from getting the medical marijuana industry going until about 3 years ago or so, when the legislature finally erected regulations for the medical marijuana industry, and now the transition to recreational pot is complete. There's still a lawsuit or two out there blocking some of it, but it did start this weekend, and they did a brisk business.
Now, as I understand it, it can't be smoked in public and it can't be smoked in the casinos. But my guess is that how long somebody's got to come up with a pot-themed casino?
Listen, I think they're putting their finger in the dike on that one. I think eventually what the casinos do is they complain about stuff until they find a way to make money off of it. And then they play, if you can't beat them, join them. And so I'm sure that that will happen eventually. Now, there may be some exceptions. You may or may not know that Sheldon Adelson, who may be the most famous casino owner in Nevada and is rapidly against legalized pot, tried to beat this initiative just as he did tried to beat one in Florida. He failed, but he's still very much against it. So we will see how that plays out on the Strip. But I do think eventually they will play again, if you can't beat them, join them on this issue, as they do many of them.
We're talking with John Ralston, who's the editor of the Nevada Independent. And, you know, generationally, I mean, Vegas has become a city. It's such a destination for young people. And, I mean, I just think generationally, the bottom line is the customer will be served.
Well, we have 40 million plus people coming here every year. That's a ready-made market, as you know, beyond whatever the local market might be. And so you're right. There's a demand here. There's a state senator who has been pushing this for a long time, who says that this is a great way to capture revenue. The taxes on marijuana here are very, very high. They're more than 25% after they passed a 10% excise tax on top of the taxes that were already in the ballot initiative. So, and most of that money is going to education. Our education system here is woeful and needs the money. So that was the way they sold it politically.
Who was behind the measure? I mean, where did the campaign money to support it come from?
Well, a lot of it came from the Marijuana Policy Project, which is a national group that has been supporting these initiatives around the country. That was the seed money, and they raised money from there. That was the main funding source. They didn't raise as much money as Adelson put in to try to fight it, but it was just, to use the cliche, an idea whose time had come here, and they couldn't stop it. It passed overwhelmingly in the two urban areas of Nevada, which is Las Vegas and Reno, and only a few of the other 15 rural counties were against it, and they just don't have the population to stop it.
You know, Nevada is one of those states where it's like there's Clark County and then there's the rest of the state. but because Clark County has such a huge population, it can have its way if enough people show up and vote. I take it that this is one of those issues. I assume that when you get out into the more rural areas of Nevada, the state becomes much more conservative.
It is. The rural Nevada is much more conservative than Clark County, which makes up about three quarters of the population, give or take. depends. It's within those that margin during elections as well, depending on what voter turnout is. Reno and Sparks, the northern Nevada urban area, is pretty much a swing county, evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. But if you can get something passed by a wide margin in Clark County, you are going to win if you're a candidate or a ballot initiative statewide, because there's just not enough votes left in the rest of the county. I believe it passed by 12 points in Clark County.
Now, how is the pot being sold? Is it pot shops, or are they state licensed places, or what's the mechanics on that? Because we're having trouble with that here. I mean, with my house, I live in the West San Fernando Valley, and I'm not kidding. There's got to be 20 of these places within a 5-mile radius. They're everywhere. They're like lawn mushrooms. They just show up overnight.
Right, and so there are a lot of pot shops that have opened. A lot of them are the medical marijuana folks who use this as a transition to sell recreational pot. But we actually did a story, not to do a shameless plug for the Nevada Independent, but my reporters did a story where we looked at all of the different jurisdictions in Nevada and how differently they're treating it in terms of zoning laws, in terms of the fees that they're charging, in terms of whether you need a special use permit or not to actually get one of these facilities. And it's very disparate. There's very little uniformity at all. So really the answer to your question is it depends where you live. We actually have a map on the site of where they all are in Nevada.
Yeah, we've got some of those maps too, and they look like there's enough dots on the map. They look like, you know, a flyover of, you know, L.A. at night, you know, with all the pinpoints of light. There's so many of them out there. Well, again, I can't see how, as more people want to smoke pot, I can't see how the casinos don't eventually have pot lounges to go along with everything else. They didn't call it Sin City because people weren't imbibing.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. I agree with you. I think eventually that they will capitulate. There are some issues, of course, with legalized pot now, and the gaming industry is worried about that, which is that it's still a Schedule One drug at the federal level, and there are bills in Congress to change that, but it doesn't look like they're going anywhere right now. And there has been talk that Jeff Sessions is going to bring, you know, federal troops into these states and close these places down, and they go back and forth on that. So I think they're going to wait till that whole thing is resolved before they do anything.
Yeah, it's this is a real problem, and this we've discussed this many times. I'm in favor of the federal government legalizing pot because I do think it matters. The whole concept of federalism is important, that federal law, the supremacy clause, that federal law supersedes state law. Otherwise, you end up in a chaotic situation where the states can nullify federal law. And we went through that from 1861 to 1865. And I don't think we should go down that road again. But in this case, the federal law to me is archaic and it's behind the times. And it's, you know, it's putting the states in a precarious place. But, you know, we're not there yet, and it's going to continue for some time into the future, I'm afraid. Follow John, by the way, on Twitter at Ralston Reports, R-A-L-S-T-O-N Reports. That's the Twitter handle. John Ralston, editor of the Nevada Independent. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for the time.
All right. Well, I wasn't shocked that the DWP workers got a raise. But even by L.A. standards, the Banana Republic method by which this contract was passed by the city council really establishes a new low. Randy, do we still have the sound from yesterday? I want to, just to set this up, preface, the watchdog, the guy who's supposed to be looking out for the ratepayers' interest, Fred Pickle, the ratepayer advocate. This is Fred Pickle talking about the a deal that offers raises up to 22% over the next 5 years. Six raises in 5 years for 9,000 IBEW workers at the DWP. And here's Fred Pickle looking out for you.
With the economy in a very hot state right now, I worry that people we brought in throughout the organization, replacing the baby boomers who are able to retire out, we may see a growth in retention problems throughout the organization.
So the ratepayer advocate is okay with the raises because the DWP may have a retention problem or lose workers to retirement and may not be competitive in getting replacements. And then here's Gil Cedillo, L.A. City Council, talking about why let's sign this bill right now because everybody's happy.
I have tremendous confidence in you, Fred. I call you Fred. If your work is done and if the committee's work is done, and the union and the working men and women of the city have said their work is done, then let's sign this agreement so that they can have a great summer.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Let's talk with the president of Consumer Watchdog, Jamie Court. Jamie, welcome aboard. How are you?
Good, good. Good to be here. I feel a little lighter in my pockets as a DWP ratepayer myself.
Yeah, well, you're not going to have a good summer, but the workers will have a good summer.
Exactly. This is a $57 million raise package. It raises, raises over 5 years, so it'll be 13% and 22%. And maybe they're warranted, but they're awfully big. The health care for DWP workers, unlike any of us, is free. That comes on top of it. The DWP workers, and I don't begrudge them, these are hardworking people, their salary is $100,000, they get $17,600 a year for health care. That's a pretty high average salary. But I also feel this is the worst department in the city of Los Angeles. And anyone who's ever dealt with the customer service of this department, particularly the people who handle the bills and the billing errors that still go on, you don't treat a group of folks that have gotten this so long with such a generous, lavish pay package. Sure, a lot of people working under the ground. It's hard work. It's just hard work. But to do it in a back room, to cancel a committee hearing, to do it really quickly under the table with the union leader who has given you, as a mayor, for instance, huge political support for your ballot measures to extend mass transit, to try to change the DWP system to make it even less accountable, something voters saw through. I mean, The people of this city have so little confidence in DWB because they deal with it every day. They deal with the bills every day. And to give this type of raise without giving them an opportunity to really challenge it and to really take it on is I think, a betrayal of the public trust. And frankly, it's the way that this mayor, Garcetti, deals with things. He turns over the lunch money. He doesn't fight for the public's lunch money. He just lets the bully take it. And he got elected saying something else. He got elected so he could take on this entrenched union, this entrenched bureaucracy, and he hasn't done anything except made it richer.
What do we have a ratepayer advocate for if Fred Pickle, the only time we ever hear from Fred Pickle is when he's providing cover for the politicians to do what the DWP wants?
Look, Fred Pickle shouldn't have his contract extended, but because he's part of the old buddy system, he will have that contract extension, I'm sure, this year. Fred Pickle, I try to find him. Once on a billing error issue. It was really hard to find him. I found him. He said, I can't talk to you because you're on the other side of a lawsuit. I said, I'm not a party in a lawsuit. It was a billing error lawsuit. I'm just an interested party. Oh, but still, you're critical of DWP and the press. I can't talk to you. I mean, the guy, and then, we went with ratepayers who had big billing errors. I mean, people have been getting bills that say they owe $25,000, and they're just wrong. I mean, they blame it on a computer system, but it's not all computer error. Fred Pickle's been largely silent on the other thing, except to support a settlement that has really got some outrageous terms for the lawyers and some of the insiders involved. And he basically, doesn't exist to help people with their bills, because we had ratepayers call, and we videotaped them, and they called DWP and explained the bills, and DWP said that these workers said the most outrageous things. Oh, no, you really owe that, or give us 10%, or we're going to turn your lights off, or... They couldn't give an answer, and they all asked at our behest for the ratepayer advocate, and they were never connected to Fred Pickle. We don't have a ratepayer advocate. Go to this website. So the public isn't even told about Fred Pickle. He's supposed to be. He used to work, by the way, as an energy analyst, so he's not a consumer advocate. We traced some of his work back to Enron when we said he should be fired. So this is an insider, and this city doesn't need an insider. That's what everybody said. We need someone who really could look at the numbers and crunch down, and someone who's an analyst as a ratepayer advocate. No, you need an advocate who's going to say, a rate hike, which just went through, is outrageous, not endorse it, which Fred Pickle did. And these type of raises are outrageous rather than an endorsement. I mean, there's no justification. Has anyone told you how many jobs DWP, are threatened at DWP because they're paid?
We have been told for years, and we've seen salary figures that show that the DWP is the highest paid public utility workers in the country. So who are we afraid we're going to lose our employees to? Who's stealing our DWP workers away with better deals?
And at least in their, at least not the line workers, but the people who work in the buildings and the people who work on consumer issues, I can tell you they're not up to snuff. I can't tell you about response times because I think those guys who work outside and work underground, I know it's hard work. But I can tell you about the bureaucracy. And every general manager that's tried to wrap their arms around it always said, no, I can't do it. I can't. And even when they were trying to sell billionaires, they had to bring workers in who were, you know, like, we got to find a tiger team because the rank and file people can't handle this. And yet we're paying an average of $100,000 a year plus $17,000 in benefits. I would never leave if I were a DWP worker. Why would I leave?
We're talking with Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog. Their website is consumerwatchdog.org. Let me ask you about, we're told this contract has big savings for the public.
Where? I haven't seen anything. The only thing is those four. There's two foundations that have been a ripoff of the public. There are two non-for-profits controlled by the heads of this union that get $4 million every year. And they have the controller. Anyone who's looked at this has said these are outrageous. They don't do anything. They pad the executives' pockets of the unions. And they've been a national embarrassment. And yet we couldn't get rid of them. So what Mayor Garcetti won, the only concession was, they've agreed not to fund $4 million a year to these two foundations anymore. But we're paying a $57 million ransom in these double-digit pay hikes over 5 years so that the mayor can say, I got rid of those foundations in this next campaign.
And here's, to me, the single biggest source of the corrupting influence of the Department of Water and Power is the fact that the surpluses that are generated, and I don't know how you can have surpluses when the pipes haven't been replaced and infrastructure collapses, but they claim that they generate surpluses every year, and the surpluses get turned over to the city to patch holes in the general revenue budget. And, Jamie, as I see it, then that means the DWP is, in essence, a taxing authority because they are raising revenues that pay for the vital services, the essential services of the city of Los Angeles, but you can't vote for anybody on the DWP board. You can't vote for Brian D'Arcy or any of those people. And as long as the city of Los Angeles is dependent upon the Department of Water and Power to fund the functions of the city of Los Angeles, the DWP will have a disproportionate influence on Spring Street.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, there was a lawsuit challenging that transfer of money, class action lawsuit saying it's illegal. And it was a tax under some rulings and some an initiative that said you can't call it a fee a tax. And they're settling that lawsuit now, and it's a pretty outrageous settlement because they actually should be transferring a lot of money back to DWP ratepayers for, I think, you know, going back, you know, about half a decade that there's, you know, legal precedent or legal ability to reach back and give money back because that the transfer is absolutely illegal. And yet they're settling the lawsuit for pennies on the dollar, and I think there may be some good cause to try to intervene and stop that lawsuit.
Well, the reason this is so corrupting is it allows the political leaders of the city to tell the public a false narrative of what it costs to run the city of Los Angeles. The truth of the matter is that they have an off-the-budget source of revenue that it doesn't appear to be taxes. Well, they let the DWP collect it for them. And, yep. And by the way, the money comes from people who don't even live in the city of Los Angeles. But in essence, you're being taxed via your electric and water bill to pay for L.A. city services. You know, if the city were to really have to pay for everything that they do, they'd have to raise taxes to do it if they didn't have access to the DWP collection agency. There's so much to talk about this. Jamie, we didn't even get into the politics of why this really happened, which is the mayor's political ambitions going forward, and he had to mend fences after pretending that he was going after the DWP and hanging it around Wendy Gruhl's neck when he ran for mayor the first time. We'll have to do that another day. In the meantime, folks, bookmark consumerwatchdog.org. It's an important website. Jamie Court, thanks for being with us. We always appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
All this weekend on KLOS, get your claws on free passes to Lobster Fest with lobster dinner. Okay, who is tapping on the aquarium? Oh. Awkward. It's the Port of Los Angeles Lobster Fest next weekend, right on the waterfront in San Pedro.
A three-day blast with killer bands, fun games and rides, and of course, an abundance of fresh Maine lobster in every form imaginable.
Win passes and eat for free on the Rock Lobster of Southern California.
95.5 KLOS.
Tickets furnished by the Port of Los Angeles Lobster Festival.
Now shopping for your family can earn you free gas.
Fill her up, Mom!
That's because you can use Plenty Points to save money on Synergy Fuel at participating Exxon and Mobil stations, the exclusive gas partners of the Plenty Rewards Program. You'll get $2 in savings on gas for every 200 Plenty Points you redeem. How great is that? So download the Plenty app and activate bonus fuel offers from Exxon and Mobil today.
Way to go, Mom!
Total amount of savings depends on points earned. Maximum of 2,500 points per gas purchase. See Plenty.com for details.
Hold everything for less. The Pack Store Save event is going on now at the Home Depot, and the shelves are full of smart storage solutions. Start with durable 27-gallon storage totes for just $8.97. They're made of heavy-duty resin to hold up to 400 pounds. At that price, you should get a few extra just to hold the money you'll save. Come get organized at the Pack Store Save event going on now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Valid through August 23rd, U.S. only.
We can save lives. The 36th annual KLOS Blood Drive, July 19th through the 22nd. Go to redcrossblood.org and schedule your appointment to donate blood and score a ticket to see Sammy Hagar at Glen Helen Amphitheater September 10th while supplies last. Driven by the helpful SoCal Honda dealers and sponsored by Paracone Juices. More info at 955KLOS.com/blood.
I remember that night talking with my friend Stacy. Well, she was really down, you know, hopeless, feeling like she had no future. I could hear and feel her pain because I remembered it happening to me. And as I listened, it turned out she was thinking about suicide. Teen suicide is a real problem, but recognizing the warning signs can help save a life. Thankfully, I got through it with Save.org. And as of now, so did she. She's much better. Help your friends at SAVE.org.
Battery Systems offers a variety of quality products, like the Odyssey battery, which provides enormous cranking power and deep cycle reserve power. The perfect battery for a variety of applications. Visit BatterySystems.net to find your closest location. Battery Systems, your single source solution.
AutoZone presents the oil change. Regular oil changes protect your engine from wear and tear, helping your car roll well beyond the 100,000 mile mark. And right now, you can get 5 quarts of Pennzoil conventional motor oil and an STP oil filter for just $24.99. So visit your local AutoZone. With over 5,000 locations, the right supplies and good advice are just around the corner. Let's get you what you need. See store for restrictions and details.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
As a small business owner, you make every dollar count. So what could you do with $10? Go to Vistaprint.com today and you'll get 500 high-quality custom business cards for only $9.99. That's less than 2 cents per card. And at Vistaprint, your satisfaction is absolutely guaranteed. So it's never been easier to turn 500 strangers into connections. Just visit Vistaprint.com and use promo code 9999 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 9999.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
Ladies and gentlemen, our next guest is one of the people that we've met over the years who I have the greatest respect for. I mean, genuine admiration. We met him under the worst circumstances possible in March of 2008. His son, Jazz Shaw, was murdered 3 doors down from his house while his mother, Anita, was serving as a sergeant with the U.S. Army in Iraq. And he had just called home to tell his dad that he'd be right home. Still had the phone in his hand when Jamil Shaw Sr. heard the gunshots outside the door and ran to his son and found him lying on the sidewalk with the phone still in his hand. And that, of course, prompted attempts to get Jamil's law passed in Los Angeles, originally authored by our pal Walter Moore. Of course, the city of Los Angeles wanted nothing to do with this. They wanted to protect the rights of those in the country illegally, even if it cost the lives of high school senior football stars. Yesterday, the United States House of Representatives passed Kate's Law. Kate Steinle, of course, was murdered in San Francisco by an illegal immigrant who had been deported 5 times, Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez. And the House also passed an anti-sanctuary city bill that would take away government grant money to cities that basically look the other way when it comes to the blight that is illegal immigration. Joining us right now on the Newsmaker line to react to all of this, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Jamil Shaw Sr. Jamil, welcome aboard. How are you?
Hey, Doug. Okay. How you doing?
I'm okay. Jamil, in the darkest days of despair, when it looked like everything, all the power of this country was lined up to just basically make guys like you go away, could you have dreamed that we would see the House of Representatives actually pass something like Kate's Law that easily could have been called Jamil's Law?
I gave Trump handed in his hand Jamil's Law, and I handed Jeff Sessions Jamil's Law one day I met him in Washington, D.C. So they both have it, and I'm sure they looked at it, and it's pretty much Jamil's Law. It's not called Jamil's Law. And with Case Law in Sanctuary City, hey, you know, it's like a new sheriff in town. And I'm sure they're worried. They'll act like, oh, no big deal. We'll give them $190,000. But, yeah, you know they're worried.
Well, they are worried, especially. I actually am hopeful that Kate's Law will get through the Senate and get to the president's desk. The sanctuary law, they're going to fight like banshees because you're going after their money. And that, of course, when you try to go after politicians' money, then it becomes a whole other level of fight. But I don't know how anybody, I really don't, I genuinely don't know how anybody of any party could oppose Kate's Law, a.k.a. Jamil's Law, and look their constituents in the face and say, who are we protecting here? Who are we supporting? Who's making the argument that people who are in the country illegally have then committed other crimes that were severe enough to get them deported, in some cases multiple times, and you want to oppose that?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. You know, to be deported that many times and come back, it's obvious that it must be pretty easy, even though they always say, oh, they're dying in the desert, and you hear all these stories about them dying. It don't seem like that's discouraging none of them, though, because they know it's worth it. You know, they get here, they get money, they get licenses, they get housing. I mean, it's almost like winning the lottery if you just get here, you know. And then for them to say, you know, all of a sudden now it's like, you know, it's real, you know. They can, like you say, Case Law says, if you come now, that's 5 years just for that. Plus, the crime you did, then you're going to get deported again, and you come back. You know, it's not going to be worth it pretty soon. You know, they're going to get old in jail, you know. So it's you know, it's a hard pill to swallow because it's all about death, and we're celebrating something that should have been in effect a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just common sense.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to celebrate for you in particular because you've got skin in the game. You lost your son, and had we had this conversation many years ago, when there was certainly ample evidence to have the conversation, your son might be alive today.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people. I always think about when, you know, everything I was doing. People call me a racist and a sellout and everything, but a dad that's pissed off. I mean, man, come on, that's my son. It's not like he's just a piece of trash. I love the boy. We raised him. And then all we got out of was a funeral, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And, you know, and it's just time for people to stand up and just realize, you know, because I'm going to do everything I can. Now that I know people are going to be held accountable, I'm going to do like everybody else is going to do. I'm going to seek out illegal aliens and you know, and time for them to ante up. You know, they should be worried. They should be terrified. You know what I mean? We understand there's some people here that are trying to do the right thing. But still, you have to deal with crossing the border. That was still a crime. And if you let that just go, it's never going to stop.
We're talking with Jamil Shaw Sr., of course, we've talked to many times. Jamil, you do a podcast. Tell people about that and how they can hear it.
Yeah, every Wednesday night at 6, you can go to jamilslaw.com and just click on it right from there. Or you can go to blogtalkradio.com/Jamil Shaw, and then you can get in the show, ask questions. And it's all about me talking about legal immigration, of course. But we talk about everything. But, of course, that's where I fit in. My son was murdered by an illegal alien from Mexico in a gang. Should have been deported. You know, Dreamer, it has everything in it. So there's no way to not put him in every single thing. So if you want to call in and get involved, if you want to hear about legal immigration, that's the place.
All right, Jamil, as always, we're obviously going to follow the path on Kate's Law as well as the Sanctuary City Bill as it goes to the Senate. And we'll have you back to keep talking about it, this issue that we're never going to stop talking about. It's too important to let it go by the wayside. This is the time. This is the time that we can actually make a real substantive difference on something that really, frankly, I thought we lost. I thought we had no chance. I thought that this ship had sailed, but the election of Donald Trump and the Republicans hanging on to the House and Senate has, and even the ruling, by the way, I think the ruling at the Supreme Court on the president's travel ban gives us reason to hope that when the inevitable court challenges come in on sanctuary policies, I think that we've got a shot at the courts now.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely just to hear that they'll put it in effect until October. lets you know that they like what they see and they understand that the president does have power to protect us. And there's people out there who won't do it. So the Supreme Court pretty much saying, we got to get out there in front of this and say, hey, you guys, the naysayers, the Trump haters, we understand you don't have to like the man, but you still have to respect the office, you know. And you have to protect the people. If people are dying, if one person is murdered by anybody not in the country, you got to go out there early before it gets infested and you can't even control it. So we're definitely on the right track. And it's, like you say, it's unbelievable that we have some ammunition now. We got the sanctuary law, we got cage law, we got the travel ban. It's like it gives us like, hey, maybe we're doing something here. So it gives you more power and more juice to keep going and keep plugging away.
All right. Thanks so much, as always, Jamil. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. Thanks for all you do.
Thanks for all you do. You guys are the boss.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Great man. He really is.
And you have to protect the people. If people are dying, if one person is murdered by anybody not in the country, you got to go out there early before it gets infested, and then you can't even control it. So we're definitely on the right track. And like you say, it's unbelievable that we have some ammunition now. We got the sanctuary law, we got cage law, we got the travel ban. It's like it gives us like, hey, maybe we're doing something here. So it gives you more power and more juice to keep going and keep plugging away.
All right. Thanks so much, as always, Jamil. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. Thanks for all you do.
Thanks for all you do. You guys are the boss.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Great man. He really is. Ladies and gentlemen, our next guest is one of America's finest actors. He's an Academy Award nominee. He, of course, created the iconic role on television of Captain Hawkeye Pierce in MASH. So many really wonderful films, as well as California Suite, Crimes of Mystery. Well, you know, Bridge of Spies. And he is also a visiting professor at Stony Brook University, where he teaches communication, and he has a new book called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Alan Alda. Mr. Alda,
hi.
Welcome aboard. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. Thank you.
I am an enormous fan, and I have to tell a personal story real quick. When I was in high school, and I was such a fan of MASH because I was a Groucho freak, and I kind of saw a lot of Groucho in Hawkeye Pierce as you played him, I wrote a fan letter to you, and you wrote a personal note back to me that I still have that was so encouraging and so supportive. And I really always felt like it was one of those little seeds that were planted that helped inspire a young kid. And I will always be in your debt for that.
Well, that's so nice. Thank you. What did I say?
You just basically, I wrote that I hope to have a career as a writer someday, and you just wished me luck, and it was one of those little, you know, things that you toss off because you did, and it was a sweet gesture that I still have 45 years later.
That's great. Thank you.
Now, but, you know, in that, you were communicating, and that's really what the book is about, is the art and science of relating and communicating, and that's really what human life is. It's whether you're a painter or whatever, you're just a couple, you have to communicate in order to interact with our fellow man.
That's right. And you know that letter that you talked about, I had your letter in my hand when I dictated or wrote on the back of the envelope my answer, and I remember, I don't remember your letter in particular, but I do remember the experience of answering all those letters that came in, and I remember that I was thinking about the person who wrote the letter. And that's interesting that you bring it up, because it's an example from my life that I've sort of forgotten about, where I was doing what I write about in the book as being important to communicating, which is to think about the person you're trying to communicate with even more than you think about the wonderful way you have of expressing yourself. Because what difference does it make how good your message is if it doesn't get in the other person's head?
Well, that's right. And I think that communication is it's the ultimate interactive activity. And a good communicator it starts with being a good listener and hearing what the other person. And I think that, like in this business, Alan, we get so many people who are frustrated because they feel like they're powerless, that they're being crushed by institutions, fill in the blank, whatever they are. And
yeah,
that no one's listening to them. And I think that that's true in relationships, too. I think a lot of relationships break down because people feel like the husband or the wife feels like they're not being heard.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I think you said it exactly right. The person who's trying to communicate something, to say, this is how I feel about things, or this is what I think we should do next, whether it's a couple talking about that or people in business, if you're saying this is what we should do next and you're not aware of the other person's point of view, then you could be working at cross purposes with yourself. You could, the more you put forth your message, the more you could be building resistance in the other person. Whereas if you're partners with them in some way, then it's a collaborative experience to arrive at something you can both work with.
The book, by the way, is called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. It's published by Random House, and of course, it's widely available. And this grew out of your work at the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, which kind of grew out of narrating and hosting Scientific American Frontiers on PBS. Tell us about the evolution of all of this.
Yeah, well, it started with communicating with scientists before it realized it really applies to everybody in the whole world. And it started with the science program where I interviewed about, several hundred scientists. And I realized that the way we were doing it was different. We just had an open conversation. I was just curious about their work. I didn't have a set of questions. And that relationship with them opened them up a little bit. They knew that they were talking to me and not to the camera. And I realized if we could teach scientists to do that so that they had that relationship with their audience that they had with me, then they'd be more personal, they'd use language we understand, and that kind of thing. And since then, the center that I helped start for communicating science has trained around the country and across the world over 8,000 doctors and scientists. And in the middle of that, I realized, wait a minute, this is for everybody, because they were telling me this is for everybody. One scientist said, this training has saved my marriage. So I thought, I got to write this. This is important for people from the boardroom to the bedroom.
And the result is the book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? We're talking with Alan Alda. Of course, everybody knows from MASH and from everything. His amazing career. And, of course,
even phone calls. Hey,
look, I'm a fan of your dad's. I think Guys and Dolls is the greatest American musical. I mean, maybe up until Hamilton came along. And I listen to the score of that still and hear your dad singing Luck Be a Lady.
He won a Tony for that. I remember the year he was so proud of that Tony.
And play George Gershwin in the Rhapsody in Blue in the movie version.
Yeah.
Alan, it's an amazing life you've had and continue to have. Thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about it. Continued luck and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It was fun talking.
And thanks for the letter 45 years ago.
Oh, you're welcome. Awesome. Thank you for sending me your letter.
All right. So California's system for funding public education has pumped tens of billions of dollars, of extra dollars, into struggling schools. In a very interesting report in the Orange County Register, a CalMatters analysis of the biggest districts with the greatest cluster of needy children found limited success, we're being generous there, after spending all this money. So let's find out about this. The education reporter at CalMatters, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show Jessica Calafatti. Jessica, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on this morning.
I appreciate it. So I remember quite a few years ago when Jack O'Connell was the superintendent of public instruction for the state of California. We had him on the show, and I asked him a theoretical question that if he could go to bed and wake up and have every penny that he could dream of for public instruction from kindergarten through, you know, PhD, what would California need to do it right? And it totally stumped him. And I asked him, I said, is the answer more? Is that just the answer? Just give us more? Because we have been incredibly generous in the state of California, in the city of Los Angeles and Orange County as well, when it comes to public instruction. People have consistently voted for bond measures, for funding for schools, and yet we don't seem to get a lot of bang for the buck.
So I think the thing to note here to start off is that California does spend less per pupil on public education than most other states. That's to do with Prop 13. We can't raise money at the local level the same way many other states can. So that's why the money that we get from the state is so important. And this money that we focused on in our report on the state's new school funding system was really important and still has an opportunity to be transformative because it's a huge infusion of cash for districts that have concentrations of disadvantaged kids. And what we mean by disadvantaged kids is low-income students. We're talking about foster youth, and we're talking about kids who are learning how to speak English. So just inherent, those problems mean that those districts need extra money to help those kids overcome those challenges. Maybe the English learners need an extra tutor. Maybe the low-income kids need, you know, more school supplies but they're not getting at home. Who knows? The point is there's not disagreement that those students deserve and need extra money to succeed in the classroom. What we tried to figure out with this analysis was how much extra money had districts gotten over these 4 years that the state has pumped extra money into them, and what did they spend it on, and then what did they achieve? And the first two questions became, you know, almost impossible to answer in many cases, which is a big problem. We don't know in most cases where this money is going.
You know, we did the story earlier today that the LAUSD, Los Angeles Unified School District, which is obviously the second largest school district in the country, just approved their budget of $7.5 billion. But it also includes layoffs of over 100 employees, mostly library aides. And at the same time that this is happening, the growth of administrators within LAUSD has been exponential. And this is why it's a head scratcher because, you know, the entire city of Los Angeles, cops, firefighters, road maintenance, health inspectors, everything that the city of L.A. does, the budget is about $8 billion. LAUSD has lost almost 200,000 students in enrollment over the last decade, and the budget is almost dollar for dollar the same as the rest of the city of Los Angeles. It just, you know, from an outsider's perspective, it doesn't seem like we have a revenue problem. We have a way the revenue was allocated problem.
Yeah, I mean, it depends who you ask. schools are going to point to those comparisons between California and other states and say, we get less per pupil. We've always gotten less, and it's not fair. And then you talk to an average taxpayer or observer, and you look at numbers like what you just mentioned. Why is the district spending so much more on administrators and cutting library aides? You know, an average parent could say, do you want an extra secretary or do you want an extra library aide? I think they're going to say, let's have an extra library aide. But it's more complicated than that. It's not just let's look at our resources and look at our needs and match one up to the other. There's, you know, union contracts to contend with. You can't just fire some people. It becomes very complicated, and that's why these issues are so tough to solve because you'd like to think that it's all about the students and what's best for them, but there are some inherent impediments to even using the money that districts receive in the best manner for the kids.
Well, and there's also a lot of propaganda put out on this in the sense that, for instance, you know, in California, they'll say that, well, we're in the bottom of the pack when it comes to per pupil spending. But it depends, again, on how you look at the numbers. One of the ways they arrive at that figure is by taking off the books bond money. And we spent billions, I mean billions, on school construction. So Cal Watchdog says we spend $30,000 a year, essentially, in LAUSD per student. So a class of 25 would be $750,000 for one class. It's an enormous amount of money when you look at what the rate of return has been.
That's another area where the inputs and the outputs don't quite match up, because there are some school facilities in LA and in other districts across the state that are literally crumbling around students and need to be replaced. There should be no question about it. And then there are other cases where, you know, new school facilities are being built that some would argue are too lavish, and, you know, they have this beautiful atrium or
We built the $500 million high school in downtown L.A. We built a $500 million high school. And there's just no evidence whatsoever that this actually increases test scores or performance or graduation rates or success later on in life. And that's why we keep coming back to we've added exponentially, as I mentioned before, the number of administrators in LAUSD. So, you know, rather than fixate on the actual number of dollars put into the system, what's perpetually missing is how is the money spent? Why is all of these billions? If we can run everything that LA does for essentially what it costs to run just the schools, you have to ask, why are teachers having to buy supplies out of pocket? I mean, why is that happening? And we ask that question year after year after year, and we just get we still get stories from teachers saying that they're out of pockets for school supplies. You know, it's very frustrating. Hey, CalMatters.org, by the way, CalMatters.org. Jessica, thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. Appreciate it. The OC Register, the piece is there. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC. AM.